Attention, you who have received this podcast. This podcast was recorded by a country that represents revolutionary justice on Earth. Before this, you may have already received other podcasts sent from the same direction. Those podcasts were sent by an imperialist superpower on this planet. That superpower is struggling against another superpower for world domination so that it can drag human history backwards. We hope that you will not listen to their lies. Stand with justice. And subscribe to the Patreon.
Patreon.
That's a great opening. Welcome to Science Fiction Book Club, a podcast for bookworms and stargazers. In every episode, we dive into the pages of our favorite science fiction novels to break down the big ideas, ask the nerdy questions, and just maybe learn a little bit about ourselves along the way. I'm your host, Opsa, and with me is my co-host,
Abu.
Oh, yeah. And today, we're going to be talking about Chapters 7 through 14 of Three Body Problem.
I'm so excited. This is a huge chunk of the book.
Oh, yeah.
We sort of started slow, but now we're really going pedal to the metal. But before we get into it, let's take care of some housekeeping, Opsa, and then we'll dive into these chapters. A lot of ground to cover today. As always, dear listener, we encourage you to read along with us. This is a book club, after all. So read along with us, share your thoughts, and email us at scifibookclubpod@loreparty.com. Of course, please also join our Patreon at patreon.com/scifibookclub. We post free reading guides and discussion questions, as well as bonus clips and bloopers. It's also where you can join our Discord to keep the nerdy sci-fi discussions going with our fellow readers in the community. So please go check all of that out. Links in the show notes.
And our game plan for today, as usual, we'll start with a summary of the chapters from today's reading. Then we'll dive into our first impressions and predictions, and finally, we'll dive deep into our sci-fi analysis. But before that, just a short ad break.
Okay, welcome back, listeners. Let's get into it. Today's summary is going to be pretty quick because there's a lot of ground to cover. It's a huge set of chapters. We're going to move through this fairly quickly and just try to refresh your memory by hitting on some of the main points. So starting with chapter 7, Wong enters the VR game Three Body Problem for the first time and is introduced to this concept of stable eras and chaotic eras. Now, as he journeys with his two companions, King Wen and Follower, they're at one point faced with the rising sun, and it starts increasing the temperatures and it's getting scorching hot. And in order to continue, Follower has to dehydrate himself.
Right.
And this apparently is something in the game that all of humanity does to wait out a chaotic era. It's a survival mechanism. And thus, the goal of this game is revealed to Wong. The goal is to create a system that can reliably predict the starts and ends of these chaotic and these stable eras. Now, once the group arrives in the Great Hall of King Zhao, King Wen presents his theory on how to predict the eras. He's got a theory, he's excited to show it off. But unfortunately, he is ultimately proven wrong when this civilization 137, freezes to death in a prolonged winter. So that's unfortunately, right. King Wen's theory, not the correct one.
And you might recall, he didn't freeze to death as he was forced to jump into a cauldron of boiling water.
Right. Don't present the king with a bad theory, lest you be boiled.
That's right. Well, in chapter 8, we move away from the game and Wang finally meets Yang Dong's mother, who it's revealed to us that it's none other than Ya Wenji.
Wow.
This is Ya Wenji's return. And
right.
She's clearly a lot older. And Ya Wenji shows Wang to Yang Dong's room. They flip through some photos and her childhood diary together, reminiscing. She tells him a little bit more about Ya Wenji's childhood and her maybe mistakes in exposing her to too many theoretical ideas at such a young age.
Right.
It's clear, of course, that Ya is still grieving and somewhat regrets the way that she raised her daughter during their time at Red Ghost Base.
Yeah, a really touching chapter. Next up in chapter 9, Wong then visits the Chinese Academy of Sciences National Astronomical Center in order to observe the cosmic microwave background. Ye Wenji recommended he go there because she has a former student that can help him out. Ye's former student, Shai Ruxin, is very eager and very helpful in all of this.
That's right.
I got the sense in the reading that he was also very bored and had little to no work to do
right
out here at this observation center. So getting to hang out with someone was quite fun for him. Ultimately, though, he is super skeptical. He kind of laughs off Wang's claim that the universe is going to flicker and that he's here to witness that event happen, because it is truly an impossibility. Scientifically speaking, that's not something that we should be able to witness.
Right.
Alas, that is exactly what they witnessed together. Just as Shen Yufei promised, the universe flickered. And when Wang translates the information coming in from the instruments, it's revealed that the universe is flickering and the countdown that he witnessed in his eyes earlier is now continuing at the scale of the entire galaxy.
Oof. Just a shocking development. And of course, he's got a witness there to confirm that it's not all in his head.
Right.
Our previous thoughts around maybe the psychological disturbances or whatever else the case might be, have been invalidated.
Totally.
It's clear that there is something going on.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, moving on to chapter 10, Officer Da Shi finds a very distraught Wang, who has just, of course, come back from seeing the entire universe flicker. And just as the other poor scientists before him, he's teetering on the edge of a breakdown of sorts, given all that he's experienced. And Da Shi is there to comfort him. I mean,
yeah,
he's, of course, continued to follow him. And for once, Wong isn't so upset by that. You know, he appreciates that he's got this ally of sorts. And of course, Da Shi in this chapter also reveals what he's pieced together of the larger mystery. The suicides, the attacks on academic institutions, the strange films that have been developed, and the bold environmental movements. And his conclusion is everything that's happening has been coordinated behind the scenes with one goal: to completely ruin scientific research.
Wow. This guy is perceptive.
He is deeply perceptive, more so than certainly Wong was giving him credit for.
Right. I really liked in their back and forth in this chapter how Da Shi was like, well, I'm not as smart as the rest of you, so I can like see through all the high-minded academia of it all.
That's
and
right.
Kind of cut to the truth of it, you know? His intuition is almost more useful than someone who's highly educated like Wong.
Right.
In trying to solve this mystery. Okay, moving on to chapter 11. Wong once again logs back onto three-body problem after his family falls asleep. He's really starting to act like me when Baldur's Gate 3 first came out. This time, in the game, he meets a character named Mosey. And Mosey claims to have solved the mystery of this universe, unlike all of those fucking losers that came before him, like Confucius over there. There's like this weird dead corpse skeleton of Confucian nearby.
Right.
Confucius. Now, his theory is simple. Mosey claims that this universe of the game is actually two hollow spheres floating in the middle of a sea of fire. And these spheres have holes of various sizes in them. And the light that penetrates these holes is what we see as stars and the sun. Big hole, sun, small hole, stars.
That's right.
Unfortunately for Mosey, his hubris bites him in the ass when his model also fails, when this mega sun burns this entire civilization to a crisp. And after having witnessed yet again another failure and leaving the game, Wong cannot stop obsessing about it. He's logging off, but he's still jacked in, baby. And in order to distract himself, he visits Yawenji again.
That's right. And in chapter 12, we flash back to Ye's time at Redco Space as she's settling into life there, slowly becoming more and more valuable to the operations. And she's starting to make some apparent allies.
Right.
In particular, the Commissar Lei, who has begun to entrust her, supposedly, with more secrets about the base's true mission, which is a weapon against spy satellites,
right,
he says.
Totally, wink, wink.
For sure, yeah, just a super microwave, is the claim. Except, no, of course not. Whoops,
no.
It's a lie. She's been betrayed again by someone she's made the mistake of trusting. And her, at the time, seeming bully, Chief Yang, in fact, has been laboring behind the scenes to get upper brass to reveal to her the true purpose of Red Coast, or I think get her off the base. And
I mean, he still offers her the option, right? He's like, you can either learn the true purpose right now, but you're locked in for life, or I'm giving you the exit. You can leave right now.
That's right. And of course, we know Yawenji by this point, she, of course, accepts and wants in.
That's right. Now, chapter 13 is a fun one. I love this. It's basically a series of declassified and redacted documents from around this time, from the 1960s, that explain the origins of Red Coast Base. Its origins as a top secret project with the primary goal of making contact with intelligent alien life. This is the chapter where we're introduced to the concept of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, S-E-T-I.
Yes, so we finally land in chapter 14, where we return to present day as Wong and Ye discuss humanity's attempts at reaching alien life. Wong, in particular, recalls Bill Mather's theory that any contact with any alien species would be divisive and totally disastrous for the human race.
Yeah,
also explains that humanity isn't even categorized as a type one civilization.
Fucking
which,
losers.
If you'll recall, isn't even categorized as a type one civilization, which, as you'll recall, is a civilization that's capable of harnessing all of the power on the planet.
Right.
And all the transmissions from Red Coast, despite their many decades of effort, were almost certainly far too weak for anyone to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, says she and her colleagues eventually gave up believing alien life existed, and essentially that Red Coast faded into obscurity until it shut down.
Wow. Very fun that we got some flashbacks to Red Coast. I wasn't expecting to go back there, but it's clear that there's a larger mystery at play. Okay, with our summary out of the way, Opsa, I'm so curious. How are you feeling? How are you feeling after this big chunk of chapters?
I mean, call me a sucker, but I am still absolutely smitten with this book. I am finding that Seishun can do no wrong. And I know that's not true. I know that's not true, but I found this to be such a fantastic block of chapters. Of course, covered a lot of ground, but we got to see, you know, some narrative arcs achieve some amount of closure. We did get to the revelation and purpose of Red Coast Base, which definitely had been on my mind. We've seen Wong Miao go through a whole narrative arc. and I have to say, I don't think he, for more than the briefest of references, mentions his wife or child
literally seven
chapters.
He had dinner with them and they went to bed. That's all we got.
It was fully one sentence of your colleagues have called, they have dinner, and no further mention of his, of, as far as we know, the only two loved people in his life.
Totally. Justice for Wong Mao's wife.
Yeah, exactly. Who still has no idea what's going on. He, of course, course, has told her nothing. There's no transparency in this household. Just absolutely shocking. And of course, we also saw him, you know, maybe reconcile with Da Shu. Like, Da Shu has possibly been redeemed in Huangzi.
He's family now. He's replaced his wife.
Well, he certainly knows much more than she does, so might as well, you know. In these seven chapters, there are about as many different, rich, fascinating themes and plot elements that we could equally dive into. And that's what, for me, is really pushing this novel into the realm of the, you know, the profound.
Yes.
Beyond that, there are just a few scenes that really humanize the characters in this novel for me and ground the high-blown science fiction and you know, lofty ideas in something that's, you know, more familiar and human. Mm-hmm. In particular, there's the end of, I believe, chapter 8, when Ye Wenji is offering Wang Miao a box of ginseng on his way out from meeting her. She's clearly seen that he's going through something. Mm-hmm. And the chapter ends with this small passage. Quote, Wang accepted the box, warmth filling his chest. His eyes moistened. It was as though his heart, stressed almost beyond the breaking point by the last few days, had been placed onto a pile of soft down feathers.
Wow.
That just emotional tension and release and that small moment of tenderness, I found to be just such a powerful antidote to what might otherwise feel like a little excessive science mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, certainly. I'm really glad you pointed that out, this humanization of the characters, because I certainly was feeling some of the mumbo jumbo in these chapters myself.
Yeah, dragging on just a little bit, particularly in the game, perhaps.
Yeah. And not only is this an amazing quote that humanizes these characters in a very dense science fiction novel, it's a great way to tell you, dear listener, about our sponsor, Brooklinen. And if you too want the stresses of the last few days to just drift off and to feel like you've been placed on a pile of soft down feathers, they're not a sponsor, but maybe someday. I'm just pitching ourselves to Brooklinen in case they're interested, you know?
Great.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Obsa. I'm having a blast in this book so far. We're now in the thick of it, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
We're in it. And between the flashbacks to Red Coast Base and the present day battle station and war and mysteries going on, it's all coming together for me. Like, it seems clear that some shit went down at Red Coast Base.
Oh,
we're not flashing back there for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
And clearly nobody remembers it, or the records of it were destroyed, or it was so ultra top secret that anyone who worked at Red Coast doesn't even know. Some shit went down, and I feel like we're going to continue to flashback in the story and perhaps unravel more of what happened.
Yeah, we're certainly not done with Red Coast Base.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's all going to connect into the modern day story. I also really wanted to call out that the novel's use of this VR video game as a way to like illustrate a problem, right? The three-body problem is a real scientific dilemma that is basically impossible to solve. You could split some hairs on that, whether it is or it isn't. But to use this video game to illustrate what is in and of itself a very dense dilemma about three celestial bodies and the gravitational effect they have upon each other, really interesting way to do that. And I loved it. It's just weird enough to be intriguing, right? But also it's diving into some like genuinely dense scientific ideas that are true to life.
Totally.
But on that note, on the note of dense scientific ideas, I have to admit that I did find my eyes starting to glaze over at some points in these seven chapters because of those lengthy, complicated explanations of scientific concepts, or even in particular, the explanations of Ye Wenji at Red Coast Base and the job she's doing and the like wavelengths of the radio transmissions and stuff.
Right.
I was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting lost in the sauce here.
Yeah.
And to maybe offer another perspective. I liked that you pulled out a human moment in that quote, but I'm starting to really feel like the characters in this story serve more as vehicles for Liu Cixin to set up these cool, nerdy, dense scientific ideas rather than being like full human people with character and emotional arcs of their own.
Right.
And so I am feeling that a little bit. I'm somebody who prefers a character-driven story, and this one certainly is an idea-driven story.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And I don't think we're alone in that critique. I've read very similar critiques online as well, where people who prefer or enjoy like a character-driven story are turned off by how truly idea-driven this novel is in particular. And the characters take a backseat to the very cool, interesting, dense ideas that Cixin wants to explore.
Right. Yeah. I find myself in the camp of really intrigued by that. And I'm really hungry for that level of kind of scientific fidelity, but not to say that I understand any of it, but it just, it feels, you know, it's like the kind of nerdy that scratches the right itch for me, you know?
Yeah. Wow. You're starting to sound like a type one sci-fi fan. Okay. I need you to up your game to a type two.
That's right. Harness the power of the sun, young
Harness.
Man.
Truly.
That's right.
All right. Well, with our impressions of these chapters out of the way, let's take a quick break. But dear listener, you're not going to want to go anywhere because some of these aforementioned dense ideas that we all read in these chapters together, we're going to dive into those next in our sci-fi analysis in just a minute.
Well, welcome back, listeners. And now we'll jump into our takeaways and do a deep dive into the ideas that make this novel so interesting.
Yep, let's do it. I'm interested to hear yours first, Hovsa.
Well, for my part, I found the game to be the thing that I just absolutely couldn't stop thinking about.
Right.
And I think it's not just an idle plot device, so probably is worth, you know, really considering and kind of discussing some of the, in this case, philosophical ideas that I think underpin its construction and its purpose in this novel. It, of course, features this concept of stable and chaotic eras, and I think that on its surface is enough to just capture the unpredictability and chaos inherent in our own universe and our own quest for knowledge, scientific and otherwise.
Right.
Specifically, I think there are two big philosophical ideas that can help us understand the practical significance of this game.
Okay.
The first goes by a few different names, but I know it as Hume's problem of induction. So David Hume was a Scottish philosopher in the late 1700s, and he specifically challenged the inductive flavor of knowledge, wherein you basically assert some conclusion based on past experiences and observations.
Okay.
So I think a ready example is the sun has risen every day for all of human history, right? Based on this, many would feel pretty comfortable asserting that it'll rise tomorrow.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
But only one man has ever risen. And thus, based on that observation, unlikely that another two would rise.
That's right. That's right. This guy gets it.
Gotcha. So are you saying that David Hume, he challenged that idea? That like
he
the past does
that
not
idea.
Always guarantee the future, like past observation does not always guarantee future result.
Exactly. There's basically, essentially what he's saying is that there's no logical connection between those that guarantees the future result from the past observation.
Mm.
And if you accept that premise and you follow it to its logical conclusion, it strikes a critical blow in our normal notions of cause and effect.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's kind of disturbing. know? And it's also basically what those metaphors we talked about last episode from The Frontiers of Science, it's basically what those are about as well. that chicken or turkey. I'm now forgetting.
right. The shooter and the farmer.
That's right. The shooter and the farmer.
Yeah, you were in the correct headspace. There are chickens and turkeys ballpark. Involved.
That's yeah. right. Well, you know, and there was, of course, that like scientist chicken that thought he understood the nature of the world based yes. on all his observations. And he was more or less right up until it was Thanksgiving.
Right.
And then all his observations were for naught.
Yes.
And we're basically seeing the players in the game undergoing the same sort of thinking. They're attempting to explain the cycles of chaos and stability based on their observations, and in some cases, based on mystical texts. But in Chapter 11, for example, one of the players in the game says the universe is a machine. We, of course, talked about that. And he's confident, you know?
Very.
Quote, I have theories too. But they're not mystical. They're derived from a large number of observations. First, do you know what the universe is? It's a machine. And to be fair, he has constructed a physical model that reflects that theory.
Yes.
So that's a step above relying on, I think, the I Ching, as in the first time when we encountered the
right.
free body.
He's even sort of relying on, he's boastful and confident that those other people who came up with concepts aren't as good as him because he's relying on observation and study and logic.
Yeah. And he, in fact, at one point says, I've already learned the secrets of the motion of the universal machine.
Damn.
My predictions cannot be wrong.
Hell yeah, brother.
This was, of course, 17 days of observation.
Before he was royally wrong.
Exactly. And as we recall, the sun roasted his ass. He was
totally.
He was immolated. And
yes.
And this is, I think, actually where the second big philosophical idea comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from this Austrian-British philosopher named Karl Popper, who was born nearly 200 years after Hume in 1902. And his basic response to this problem was a scientific theory is one that is falsifiable. That's the big idea, really, that you simply cannot rely on induction or inference to make a theory sound and valid. For it to be a scientific theory, you have to have a test that could possibly invalidate it. It's not enough to have an elegant theory of the universe if there's no way to falsify any of its claims. If there's no test that we could possibly run to assess whether the theory is false, then essentially it's not scientific.
Wow.
So that kind of helps inform our current picture of science and the modern practices. And it's how scientific progress is made. It's not just empirical observation, but it's rigorous testing to attempt to invalidate those theories. So there is no sense that your predictions cannot be wrong in science. Ideally, you are attempting to invalidate your theories.
Right.
And
your predictions should be so right that it should require further testing to prove them wrong, basically. Do I have that right?
Something along those lines, yeah. The whole quest is not from a point of, we know this to be true and I'm confident in it, but
yeah.
How do I prove this to be false? And that is the rigor that scientific
okay.
theories require.
Right.
And it's interesting because in the game, the players are failing to grasp that concept. But outside the game, it's the scientists who are failing to grasp the nefarious plot against them.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting juxtaposition there. It's in fact the non-scientific former soldier and disgraced detective, Da Shu, that emerges as the unlikely figure that perceives the broader conspiracy at play.
Right.
This completely... You know, he's completely disinterested in science. I found that such an interesting thing to compare and contrast the world
right.
outside and the world inside the game.
Yeah.
It kind of defies any overly simplistic characterization of Cixin's motives or his attitudes about science. And it really underscores our human limitations. At the end of the day, we're all in the same boat. Tomorrow isn't here. The sun hasn't yet risen. And some humility in the face of that is probably appropriate.
Wow. Damn. Hope so. That was poetic. What the fuck? Wow. Amazing stuff. within this context, I am beginning to appreciate the dense ideas in this story, you know, like, that, like with this greater understanding.
Yeah. I mean, it is what makes this such an interesting novel.
Yeah.
And with that all said, I don't know. Tell me what captured your attention? What really hooked you? And what do you want to dive into?
Okay. I want to talk about the aliens. Are they here? Did they build the pyramids?
Probably.
Have
almost
you seen
certainly.
That History Channel show?
That's right.
Okay. So for my takeaway, I wanted to spend some time exploring the fictional Bill Mathers theory.
Right.
About first contact and how it would be an objectively bad thing for all of humanity. I emphasize fictional there because I spent so much time Googling Bill Mathers, trying to find the actual theory because I thought it was real. And it's
okay.
Not.
Okay.
Bill Mathers is not a real person.
I certainly thought it was real. I was confident. I was like, certainly, this totally makes sense. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. I took Shishin at his word there, assuming everything in this novel is true. And I was humbled when I Googled Bill Mathers and was immediately told not a real person.
Right.
But to get into the theory that Bill Mathers is talking about, Liu Shishin basically lays out what I learned from my research is literally his opinion on first contact. It is basically Bill's theory. Quote, "The impact of such contact on human society would be divisive rather than uniting." End quote.
Interesting.
And Bill's theory in the story goes on to conclude that the degree of this contact doesn't matter at all. Just the very existence of alien life and the knowledge that it exists is enough to throw humanity into disarray.
Interesting. Yeah.
And of course, as we know from those redacted documents, China's very aware of this, but it also has massive geopolitical consequences as well if we were to make first contact. Quote, "If such contact were monopolized by one country or political force, the significance would be comparable to an overwhelming advantage in economic and military power," end quote. And of course, that's the whole purpose of Red Coast Base.
Right.
So this theory from the book led me down a rabbit hole of research into first contact.
Yeah.
To see if there are any real life versions of Bill Mathers' ideas. And the short answer basically is, yeah, like this is not some new idea. What Shishin presents as Bill Mathers' view in the book is a popular one among real life academics and storytellers as well. And this theory is based on observation. It's based on the long and dark history of humanity itself on planet Earth. If we take a look at instances in history where a technologically advanced culture came in contact with a primitive one that was decades or centuries behind, the primitive one, in almost every single case, is effectively wiped out from existence.
Right, right. I mean, we don't have to look much further than the first chapter of this book and the struggle sessions. And it's basically the youth revolting against their elders in the scientific community. And just the heretical ideas of science were enough to cause great division and panic. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I totally find it plausible.
Right. So, Bill Mathers, not a real guy, but his ideas are real. Many people believe in that. This led me down further into the rabbit hole. Follow me, dear listener. Let's keep going. In a December 2017 article in The Atlantic by Ross Anderson, which is titled "What Happens If China Makes First Contact," the writer visits this, at the time, brand new state-of-the-art radio dish in China. And as part of the article, he also sits down and interviews Liu Shishin about first contact.
Wow.
And Shishin, in that article, in the interview, makes it very clear which camp he falls in. He believes that we as humanity will never make first contact because he believes that any sufficiently advanced civilization out there is not going to be dumb enough to broadcast themselves to the universe and invite extermination.
Interesting.
And this, in his books, he explores this in further books in this series as well, actually, is his quote-unquote dark forest theory, which, quote, "conceives of every civilization in the universe as a hunter hiding in a moonless woodland, listening for the first rustlings of arrival," End quote.
Mm. Wow. What a scary way of putting that. Super eerie. Interesting.
Terrifying stuff.
It's truly terrifying.
And of course, this is a very pessimistic view. Xixin's view, very pessimistic here. He also emphasizes in this interview in The Atlantic how truly young humanity is on a cosmic scale.
Right.
And how if we were to actually come in contact with an advanced civilization, we'd never even fucking begin to understand them.
Right.
He says, quote, especially those that may last millions or billions of years, he said. When we wonder why they don't use certain technologies to spread across a galaxy, we might be like the spider, wondering why humans don't use webs to catch insects. End quote.
Yeah. Doesn't think the most of humanity, I will say, based on these few sections.
Yes, absolutely. But again, I am blown away by the way Xixin's mind works.
Yeah, totally.
Now, to continue further down this rabbit hole, I did find other points of view out there, other camps of thought that are more optimistic about first contact. And the primary argument that I came across was that if we were to actually come in contact with such an advanced species that, say, survived for a million or a billion years,
right,
presumably they like kind of understand the concept of peace because they wouldn't be around for so long if they didn't have some sort of internal stabilization within their society.
Right.
And so the hope is that they're wiser than us, like we're maybe the babies on the cosmic scale and they're the grown-ups.
Yeah.
Optimistic, certainly, but in a way that makes sense to me. Now, further down the rabbit hole, there is another scenario that's even more rare than us coming in contact with an advanced species. But were we to stumble on like a primitive alien intelligence somehow?
Right.
I found a BBC article in which Susan Blackmore, who's a writer and visiting professor at the University of Plymouth in the UK, she told the BBC this, and this quote really stuck with me. If we were to find, for example, a primitive species, quote, could aliens suffer? Blackmore asks. If so, we should have some moral obligation towards them and perhaps even build legal frameworks on the basis of this. End quote.
Huh.
And that's so fascinating because, of course, the hope is that if we are the spider and an advanced species finds us, they have the same feeling about being right, morally obligated to not instantly crush us.
Yes. And then so perhaps that they have some framework for how that first contact would look.
Exactly. Exactly.
We certainly don't seem to have that as far as I know.
You're correct. You're absolutely correct, Obza. We have no legal framework for how humanity should act if first contact is made with any kind of extraterrestrial species. In the BBC article, it actually clarified that, quote, all five of the major space treaties center around what humans do in space and how this affects other humans, end quote.
Makes
sense. It's basically just don't leave your satellite trash in the space and
right,
don't like blah, blah, blah. It's just how humans interact with other humans in space, basically.
Right. And don't pollute.
Don't
clean
pollute
up after yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Take off your shoes before you enter the space station. Just normal things.
Right. That's just damn polite, you know. Like, we don't need right, to put that in legal writing. Take your goddamn space boots off before you walk into my cubby.
Oh, that's right.
So there is no legal framework that would hold up in the court of law, of course. But I kept going down the rabbit hole. At this point, I could not stop. I just kept Googling and reading stuff. The SETI Institute, which is a nonprofit research organization located in Silicon Valley, did in 2010 create this non-binding set of protocols for first contact.
Interesting.
And it's super interesting. We can post it in the show notes if people are interested, but these protocols basically recommend cooperation among world powers. Quote, the discoverer shall report this conclusion in a full and complete open manner to the public, the scientific community, and the Secretary General of the United Nations, end quote.
Huh.
That's one of the steps of this protocol, were first contact to be made by humanity.
Interesting.
And it's very optimistic. It's very sort of kumbaya, tell everyone about it.
Don't know that Lee Xixin would be very happy with that. Tell the public so they can panic and kill themselves?
Totally, yeah. Totally.
Right.
Yeah, telling the public seems like a bit of a red flag there.
How is that the first item in that list of people to notify? The right. Public comes before the UN and the scientific community?
Hilarious, yeah. At the very least, I'm like calling the president first before I tweet it out that
right.
An alien texted me, you know? Now, okay, so to wrap up these like big, dense ideas about first contact that I found, I do want to take a step back and zoom out because we haven't made first contact, to be clear. At least the public doesn't know about it, right?
That's it.
So what is the point of all of this? Why bother worrying about first contact? Why putting anything in legal documents? Why build a framework? What's the point of all of this what if talk?
Right.
And in this same BBC article that I was reading, I found a really beautiful quote by Jill Stewart, who is a specialist in outer space law at the London Science of Economics, that I wanted to share because it nearly brought me to tears. Quote, "We search the universe to discover ourselves because it forces us to reflect back on how we relate to each other, how we relate to our environment, and how we relate to other species and people," she says. "These future-focused scenarios may never happen, but the whole process has value in and of itself." End quote.
Wow.
I was taken aback by that.
Yeah.
Because, of course, she's talking about first contact here, but in a beautiful way, this encapsulates a lot of what this very podcast is about and why we love science fiction stories so much.
Do we need to get Jill Stewart on the podcast?
Jill,
third co-host? Incredible.
That might introduce perhaps a three-host problem, but my God. I read that and I was like, frankly, that's like this podcast mission statement. Jill just like right. did the work for us. We love science fiction so much, not because all of these future scenarios may happen, but because they have value in and of themselves to explore. It tells us more about ourselves, about how we relate to each other, to the environment, to non-humans on this planet. That's what science fiction does. And that's why science totally. Fiction is so beautiful and why we love it so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I really wanted to share that. She's talking about first contact, but I think it applies to all of science fiction storytelling as well.
Yeah.
I am curious, as we wrap up my takeaway here, where do you land? Are you in the Shishin camp of dark forest theory, first contact bad? Or do you lean more humanity could come together, it could be a positive, maybe first contact is a good thing?
Yeah, I certainly had never thought about this dark theory or this dark forest theory of Shishins and the notion that putting any of us out there is a risk to humanity. Though I do find that plausible. I guess I find myself in a third camp, which you did kind of, you know, hint at, which is the one wherein there is no communication channel between us. They are so advanced, or their version of language is one that we could never possibly translate. And that to me feels like maybe the most plausible version, personally, that I think like we often want to anthropomorphize, you know, aliens
totally.
and also clouds, like anything that we could possibly set our eyes on, we somehow or the other read humans into it.
Yes.
And for me, when I think about, you know, what a first contact could possibly look like or what aliens out there might be like, I kind of like immediately suspend my imagination and just tell myself, there's no way that you can actually conceive of what these beings could be like, because it's such a hard thing to kind of, I think it's a much easier trap to fall into thinking they fall under the same characteristics that we normally define humans with, like good and evil or aggressors and victims. I think like that feels like a very natural way of wanting to describe them, but when I think about aliens, I have to tell myself it's probably going to be nothing like anything we could maybe even describe on paper.
Totally. I agree that I think even if such contact were made, it would be like impossible for us to understand.
Right.
Because they would be so foreign and so alien to our ways of thinking. Just think of the cosmically impossible statistics of other humans existing out there.
Right, right.
Even if they're not totally human, but like humanoids?
Right.
What?
Right. Right. Right.
Like
exactly.
That is basically all but impossible, statistically speaking, on a universal scale of that happening on the other corner of the universe or something. So yeah, I agree. They would just be so foreign to us that I think even coming to an understanding would be like a near impossible challenge.
Yeah.
It's kind of dark to think about, you know, like the more you think about it, it's less the like Star Treks and Star Wars of the world.
Right.
And it's more the, oh, we're fucked of the worlds.
Something like that. Yeah.
And I, even in my research, I didn't mention this in my takeaway, but one of the SETI Institute scientists was also interviewed for that BBC article. And he mentioned like, I do think we will make contact. I think it'll just be like radio contact and they'll be so far away that we'll have hundreds of years to figure out how to actually work with this said alien.
Right.
But he also said that if there is a scenario where the aliens like literally show up on our doorstep in a ship or something, like we are well and truly fucked.
Yeah.
Because if they're capable of doing that without our knowledge, like without us sensing anything in the galaxy, like they're so far ahead of us that like it's laughable. Like they just don't work on the same plane of existence that we do.
Right. We're just butter to their hot knife. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's the more I dug into this, the more I felt like, it was mind-bending stuff to think of an actual real first contact scenario and not something fun that I've just like played in video games or read in books.
Sure, sure. It is definitely a little unsettling.
But
on the other hand, the other side to it is kind of, it's actually what, Susan Blackmore, the professor at the University of Plymouth was hinting at, that we probably should consider what contact with a less advanced species would look like and our moral obligation towards them,
right?
Which to me really casts a light on all the aliens on planet Earth, which is the animals, the creatures.
Yes.
You know, have you seen a starfish or like a capybara? These are Pokemon. These are like living
full-on Pokemon.
And we don't
that fish with the light bulb thing.
Oh my gosh, that's right. And jellyfish, you know, just like living for forever, or
Totally.
And we haven't yet, at least, although there is some work with whales. I don't know if you're seeing this, that we might be able to crack whale language.
No way. Okay.
That's a recent development, but that'll be our first time, I think, communicating with any of our native aliens. So
we don't have to look that far. That's a great point. Yeah. I don't know how much of a Trekkie you are. I'm not a bit big on Star Trek, but there is that concept of the prime directive.
Yeah.
This idea that if you humans come across a super primitive alien species, that's nothing more than just like bugs or something, don't get involved.
Right.
Leave it alone and let it evolve at its own pace. Like human intervention could cause more damage or accidentally eradicate this unknown primitive alien species.
Right.
And we truly like, I don't know, man, like, why don't we have a prime directive in Congress in writing somewhere?
Fair. Yeah.
I certainly agree with Blackmore's idea that like we have this moral obligation not to tamper with an intelligent species out there somewhere or even here on planet Earth. And I'm not so confident that humans are good at doing that.
Nothing in our history would suggest that. That's probably what Seishin's concern is, essentially.
Right.
If they're anything like us, we should be worried.
We should be worried. Yeah. We're not exactly the pinnacle of a cosmic civilization.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Villains or heroes, I think TBD, but.
Yeah, totally. Wow. What a conversation. My God. Hope so. This was so fun.
This was a great one.
We got into some nerdy stuff, and I can't wait to hear what our listeners think of all this, right? This is just what I was able to find in my research, but I bet there's so much that I missed.
Oh, there are so many rabbit holes to fall down. I cannot wait to have the discussions in Discord about this.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that wraps up today's episode. And as always, we have homework for you, dear listener.
That's right.
For the next episode of this podcast, make sure you've read chapters 15 to 20 of Three Body Problem. And as always, a reminder, the entire season's reading schedule is always in the show notes. so you can always make sure you're on top of the reading and prepared for upcoming episodes. So check that out as well.
Indeed. Well, friends, we can't comment on whether we're the heroes or villains of this podcast, but you can. So leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and be sure to check the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com.
You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, everything that's happening is coordinated by someone behind the scenes with one goal: to sabotage this podcast.